Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean, the host for the show called Getting It Done. I have to apologize today. We don't have a lot of time, so there any commercials that I normally provide will not be aired. So those of you who are paying me for your advertisement, I'm sorry. I just can't take your money. In any event, today's show is one that I've wanted to do for some time. And I'm very so happy to be back in the saddle again and broadcasting. I just had a whole bunch of issues that I had to deal with. And some of them are now on the shelf and some of them are hanging out there by there's nothing I can do about it. I'm not going to continue to talk about it because I really want to talk about the show itself. Our featuring artist, and I say artist, I'm talking about two people. Today, we're going to be listening to none other than the great Mr. Roy Hargroves and Phyllis Hyman. Let's start with Roy Hargroves, who is considered to be one of the most promising up-and-coming artists, especially when he won the Grammys that he won two Grammys, actually, in fact. And in 2006, and also in 1999. But he is no longer with us, and we're gonna miss this man. He left here kind of quick, and he was born in Texas, and in 2018, but he graduated from attended Berklee School of Music. And after a short life, just only 48 years of age, left us here. But one thing that I liked about Roy Hargroves, was his really unique sound, smooth. It was on that same level with the Miles Davis. Clarity of tone, it was just beautiful. Well, let me stop talking and let you hear the great Roy Hargroves. He's with a band called the WRD Big Band. And this was a full concert. Give a listen. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Roy Hondo.
songs that were written, arranged, and played by Roy Hargrave. By the way, for those of you who may be listening in, this is Getting It Done, and I'm your host, Dr. Walter Dean. More importantly, Roy Hargrave, for those of you who are just not on the same level as a lot of other people knowing who some of these people are, Roy Hargrave is a trumpet player. So when you heard that clear sound before, it was Roy Hargrove that was performing it. I wish we could play more of his music before it's time to leave. However, it's not going to happen. I'm going to go on to our next guest. She left here, packed up her suitcases, and went to heaven some time ago. I thought was probably one of the best, prettiest voices that I've ever heard in my entire life. I mean, that's including Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, all these other people. But in terms of the bass of her voice and the strength that she possessed, it was really ridiculous. I'm talking about none other than the great Phyllis Hyman. So we're going to listen to some of her background, and we're going to find out more about the great Phyllis Hyman.
Was used to bigger hit.
Hyman was a musical genius.
She had a tremendous presence.
She was a total creative package.
They kind of struggled with how to market her.
Pop radio didn't know who Phyllis Hyman was.
She never was a big seller. It had to be demoralizing.
She was going through a lot of these different mood swings.
She would say things like, "I have demons."
Her work started to become her enemy.
She had come to the end of her rope. She felt that it was her life and she could do with it as she pleased.
There was only one Phyllis Hyman, and after her, there'd never be another one.
Uncompromised, unrecognized, unparalleled, unsung. The story of Phyllis Hyman.
There used to be a time in the life of me for love. And we shared this apartment together, just for two.
In 1987, Phyllis Hyman reached the peak of her career, scaling the charts with a deeply personal ballad called Living All Alone.
When you consider the lyrics, I can't stand this living all alone. How many of us have been alone and felt that way? Her voice was soothing, but then she could wake you up on command.
Had risen from obscurity to become one of R&B's rising stars. She was a photographer's dream, a compelling personality, and a deeply expressive singer who found ways to make every song her own, from ballads to Broadway.
The fans loved Phyllis Hyman. At that point, she was beloved. whatever she did, whatever she released, they clamored for that music.
Her life experiences is what came out in her music. It's so beautiful. When you talk about singing something about to make you cry, because she has cried, she could put that in the music.
But if Phyllis Hyman's potential seemed limitless, so was her vulnerability. As she fought to stake her path as an artist, she struggled to contain inner demons that few of her friends were even aware of. A toxic brew that would ultimately imperil her career and her life.
Does she reach the success levels that she did throughout her career? It's amazing. But I know personally what she struggled with. I know she struggled hard.
Too much stock was taken in the trends instead of seeing her as an individual, seeing her as someone special, someone who has something to offer. No one really understood her as the Phyllis Hyman, the person. And I think at some point she just felt alone.
Up on the predominantly black south side of Pittsburgh in a housing project called St. Clair Village.
In the 50s, St. Clair Village was really a paradise. It was beautiful, it was well kept, it was safe. There were lots of children. The parents looked out for everybody.
Phyllis's parents, Philip, a barber, and Louise, a homemaker, moved to Pittsburgh from Philadelphia shortly after her birth in 1949. As she grew, so did her family.
There were 7 kids. Phyllis was the first, the oldest. 2 years later was myself. About less than a year and a half, there's Jeannie right behind me. You got Sakina, then Rashid, and the twins, Anita and Michael.
But Phyllis was first in more ways than one.
She stood out in the family as being a star. I mean, even as the star of the family.
By the time Phyllis got to junior high, that star was on the rise.
I was in the living room, and the radio was on in the kitchen, and she was singing to the radio. And then there was only one voice. And so I walk into the hallway for some reason and realized that that was her singing. I could not believe that she sounded better than the person on the radio.
At Pittsburgh's Carrick High School, Phyllis joined the chorus, where her vocal talents were nurtured by music teacher David Tamburi.
He was the first one to offer her something. He offered her voice lessons, and she would go regularly for years.
Phyllis never looked back, awarded the first ever music scholarship to Robert Morris, a local business college. She left after 1 year to devote herself to singing. In the late 1960s, inspired by the jazz stylings of Nancy Wilson and the Black Nationalist Movement, she formed a socially conscious female trio called the Sounds of Ebony, then hit the road with the jazz sextet called New Direction, then joined an R&B band called All the People. Moving to Miami in 1972, she honed her craft and paid her bills, singing in local clubs.
Out of the necessity to earn a living, she was doing some top 40 stuff. She would throw in some jazz songs when she could. She was funny, she was witty, and she brought that into her stage performances.
In 1973, Phyllis took a gig on a cruise ship where she met a Jamaican singer named Larry Alexander.
The guy in the next room was singing and practicing, and he was driving her crazy. So finally, one day, he opened the door, and she got to see what he looked like. And he was gorgeous. And she wasn't hard to look at either.
Phyllis returned to Miami with a new man and a new career plan.
Being a businesswoman was very important to me. And so what my plan was, since people were paying to hear me sing, then paying for this, put your own group together, leave the other group where you're getting a salary, be in charge, run everything, you'll make all the money.
She formed her own band called PH Factor.
I met the woman. She was like one of my sisters or something. She was just watching soap operas and talking about stuff like that. But she could sing, man. She could really sing. I don't recall ever an audition where we didn't get the gig.
Under Phyllis's direction, PH Factor developed a sound that was eclectic and distinct.
I never heard anyone sing with such freedom. We would end up playing some, you know, Miles Davis, Bitches Brew jams, and Phyllis would do the parts of Miles' horn, those weird horn parts with no, you know, she was amazing. She had no fear in that way.
With PH Factor, Phyllis cut her first record, titled Leaving the Good Life Behind, produced by Larry Alexander. Her confidence growing, she and her band decided to move to New York. But Phyllis's real journey had just begun.
I said, I'm going to come and get you and record you. She says, oh, everybody tells me that.
Phyllis Hyman and her band PH Factor arrived in New York in December of 1975, ready to make a name for themselves.
New York was very fertile in terms of the music. I think that there was really commitment on the part of major record companies to really put money into making records, promoting them, marketing them.
One day after their arrival, PH Factor landed a job at the popular Upper West Side restaurant club Russ Brown's. By early 76, Phyllis was performing there regularly before an audience filled with music royalty.
Any night, it was Ashford Simpson, Ahmad Jamal, Stevie, George Benson. And I look over at George Harrison. That's surreal.
And then this woman, I'm going to describe as like something out of Vogue, walks out. Then she opened her mouth. At that point, I became a Phyllis Hyman groupie.
They were all in this tiny club watching me sing, and I was in shock. I couldn't believe these people didn't have anything else to do on a Saturday night but come hang out with me.
She was tall, beautiful, and her voice was just really, I mean, she was magnetic.
After one of Phyllis's shows, Richard Clay introduced himself.
I didn't tell her that I'd just been to a rehearsal earlier with Norman Connors. The first thing I was going to do at his rehearsal the next day was to tell him that I met this fabulous singer.
Norman Connors was a producer who was quite prominent on the scene, and part of what he's best known for is identifying other talented artists and surrounding himself with those people.
So I'm going to the club almost every night, and here comes Richard Clay with Norman Connors. And I said, well, there it is.
So I'm going to come and get you and record you. She says, oh, everybody tells me that. I said, I'm going to come back and get you in a week or two.
Connors asked Phyllis to cover the 1972 stylistics hit, Bet You By Golly Wow. Gomes arranged the song.
We just left it very light because we wanted to make sure it didn't detract from Phyllis's performance.
She took to the music, you know, the lyrics and the melodies, the arrangements. She just took to them like a bird to the sky.
There's a spark of magic in your eyes.
Blew my mind. Bet You By Golly Wow, I think, was the first song that I heard her sing. And I just, wow, that was incredible. I mean, I thought, you know, she had this incredibly rich voice.
Phyllis' solo career took off when Bootle Records released Connors' 1976 LP, You Are My Starship, which included a duet with Phyllis and Michael Henderson called We Both Need Each Other. It peaked at 3 on the R&B charts.
She has really arrived. She's on the radio. I mean, see, I can believe someone would pay her to sing someplace. But when you turn on the radio and your sister's on the radio, it was mind-boggling.
Following a successful summer tour, Buddha signed Phyllis to a solo deal. In 1977, Buddha released her debut album titled simply Phyllis Hyman.
One thing that is absolutely clear when you're listening to that first Phyllis Hyman album is that she is a soulful singer.
As Phyllis began production on her next album, Buddha was taken over by Arista Records, whose chief executive, Clive Davis, was a music industry legend. Pairing him with Phyllis Hyman looked like a match made in heaven. It turned out to be anything but.
You can't have more than one artist at the time being at the top. But she wanted to do it her way.
Not necessarily with the people that Clive Davis wanted to do it with.
Phyllis Hyman was a star on the rise and working for a music executive with a Midas touch.
Well, we know Clive Davis to be have the reputation of being a star maker, and just about every artist that he put his hands on, from Bette Midler to Janis Joplin, he had tremendous success.
He wanted her to cross over, not just R&B, but he wanted her to cross over in pop. He wanted her to sell not just 200,000 or 300,000 records, or 500,000. He wanted to sell 2 and 3 million records, 5 million.
Phyllis went to work on a new album titled Somewhere in My Lifetime. To produce the title song, Clive Davis called on another legend, Barry Manilow.
It was a beautiful marriage for that album because Barry Manilow has a sensitivity towards beautiful ballads and material. And essentially, that's what he touched with Phyllis.
Somewhere in my life.
My mind about how I wanted to approach music after hearing that, because her lows were so rich and so beautiful.
Somewhere in my lifetime, you've been here with me, oh, so close to me.
Oh my God, that just like, that just takes me out, you know?
Somewhere in My Lifetime was released in January of 1979. The single reached number 12 on the R&B charts, but Clive Davis was used to bigger hits than that.
I'm sure that his intention in putting Phyllis with Barry Manilow for doing Somewhere in My Lifetime was that it would be a massive pop hit, and it wasn't. Maybe it didn't get promoted properly, maybe radio, pop radio, didn't know who Phyllis Hyman was. She was a new artist to them.
As a career struggled to take flight, Phyllis looked for comfort in a personal life. In September of 1978, she and Larry Alexander were married.
And his support made us feel comfortable that she had someone behind her that would be supportive and not stand in her way and to prevent her to going to where she wanted to go.
To guide Phyllis's follow-up album, Davis chose a promising team of R&B producer-songwriters, James Entume and Reggie Lucas. Entume and Lucas crafted an album's worth of ballads and mid-tempo songs, but the 7-minute title track struck a different chord.
Measure,
Know How to Love Me. Not only was it a great dance record, but her vocals over it were just amazing. Oh, my God.
Charts, with the album selling nearly 400,000 copies.
It turned out to be a massive success and actually took Phyllis to a whole nother level in her recording career and gave Arista what they were looking for, which was a big hit with Phyllis Hyman.
But while Phyllis was enjoying that success, Arista Records was signing more female vocalists to its roster, including Angela Bolfield, Dionne Warwick, and Aretha Franklin. Phyllis was no longer the only diva on the block.
You can't have more than one artist at a time being at the top. So Phyllis got caught in the competition within the record label.
That professional competition began to affect Phyllis's personality.
In 1980, I seemed to notice some irritability. She was having what I would call mild, short periods of depression. I think both the pressures of the job, the lack of any privacy. So I started seeing a fraying around the edges.
For the next album, Davis settled on a familiar face and friend with a track record of hits, Norman Connors. But Phyllis was growing frustrated by her label's commercial vision.
One place where she wanted to sell, and she wanted to do it with the musicians and arrangers and the people that she wanted to do it with. Not necessarily with the arrangers and the musicians and the people that Clyde Davis wanted to do it with.
During production of the album, Phyllis sang at a local jazz club where she was spotted by an arranger for an upcoming Broadway musical, Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Ladies. Phyllis was invited to audition for a leading role.
I think that their interest in her was because at the time she was quite a force to be contended with, and her voice just wrapped itself around the music.
Phyllis saw a chance to stretch her wings and expand her audience, but not everyone agreed.
I don't think Clyde Davis wanted her to do it for some reason. I never could understand that. But he didn't think that she should do a Broadway play. But she did it anyway.
Phyllis Hyman would stand her ground, whatever the cost.
She was not one to just go along, to get along. And unfortunately, that didn't work well for her.
Duke Ellington's Sophisticated Ladies opened on Broadway in March of 1981 at the L'Enfantine Theater. It featured Gregory Hines, Hinton Battle, and Phyllis Hyman.
I never seen all this glamour. The costumes were like amazing, but she was like a pro.
The theater community acknowledged Phyllis's exceptional work by nominating her for a Tony Award for Best Featured Actress in a Musical.
I'm extremely nervous. I'm scared to death. I really am scared. I'm signing Hyman Phyllis. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Don't forget, keep your fingers crossed.
Phyllis didn't win the Tony, but she did take home a Theatre World Award. Meanwhile, the next album, Can't We Fall in Love Again, was released soon after the Tonys. The album peaked at number 12, and the title song, another duet with Michael Henderson, reached number 9 on the R&B charts, giving Phyllis her first top 10 single.
She was getting more recording opportunities, and she was getting modeling opportunities. The world was her oyster, and she could just, you know, command anything that she wanted to do. People were there to do it.
But the combination of recording, personal commitments, and 8 stage shows a week became too much of a good thing.
She became short-tempered sometimes because it was frustrating for her coming up there and singing the same songs, particularly having to do it in pretty much the same way every night, was not a thing that she was very happy with.
Phyllis wasn't happy with her marriage either. She and Larry Alexander divorced, ending a personal and professional relationship that had lasted nearly a decade.
Larry and Phyllis, not all the time, but there were some verbal battles because I would come to their house and I'd hear it. It wasn't an easy situation.
Sophisticated Ladies closed on January 2nd, 1983, after a 22-month run and 767 performances. Phyllis emerged from that triumph with new expectations for her career.
I think she felt that she had gained enough ground and enough promotion from the show that she was now a celebrity and she could call her own shots.
But her fourth Arista album, Goddess of Love, didn't reflect that.
It was very obvious to me from direct conversations that Phyllis Hyman and I had that she did not like working with Clive Davis. I mean, there is no way I can phrase that any other way. As an artist who had a sense of herself and what she wanted to be, she felt that he was not seeing her vision for who she was, and he, in turn, was seeing her as someone who had potential but needed the kind of material that would propel her to another level. And she was resistant to that.
Her personality was one that, you know, you just couldn't talk to her any kind of way or couldn't tell her what to do. She was not one to just go along, to get along. And unfortunately, that didn't work well for her.
Phyllis turned to managers Glenda Gracia and Sidney Francis for outside help.
Her business was not in the greatest shape that it could have been at the time that I started working with her. Phyllis needed someone that she could respect, truly and truly could respect, knowing what it was that she needed to do as a business professional.
To help her do that, Phyllis and her team hired fashion designer Cassandra McShepherd, who looked for unique ways to set off Phyllis's beauty and style.
An entertainer on stage should be so set apart from any audience member. They should look like a star. And with Phyllis's 6-foot-tall stature, we were really already there. It was just for me to embellish her.
This is Cassandra McShepherd, New Year's Eve tuxedo. Yes. I'm a bellman. Where's your
bag? Phyllis was known for the plunging V-necklines and the crowns that she wore. She loved hats. She loved accessories. She was a kind of ultra fashion diva.
Hoping to get back in the studio, Glenda tried to mend the strained relationship between Arista and Phyllis.
I don't think either side, to be honest with you, trusted each other. And I'm not saying that there was not good reason on either side, but there was this thing that needed to get reconciled.
By 1984, Arista had signed a dynamic new vocalist named Whitney Houston. That same year, Glenda met with Arista's VP of A&R to discuss Phyllis's future. When she got there, he dropped a bombshell.
He told me that Phyllis was going to be let go from the label. And Phyllis, even though she had mixed emotions about the label, for her to feel like she had been fired, basically, was very, very disturbing for her.
Dropped by Arista Records in 1984, Phyllis Hyman was uncertain about her recording future.
She had great reservation about getting into a new deal.
But an offer from legendary Philadelphia International Records changed all that. Founded in 1971 by songwriters Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, PIR was known as the sound of Philadelphia.
I thought Phyllis Hyman could bring to our label a voice that could create standards, that could record songs that would be around forever. She had a sincere sound in her voice. She almost had like a tear in her voice. That's the way I would describe it.
I knew that he got her, that he understood the passion behind her, that he understood how she could really perform those songs that would tug at you emotionally.
In 1985, Phyllis signed with PIR. For her debut album, Gamble wanted songs that Phyllis could make her own. Songs like Living All Alone.
Just to be a dime in the lap and you were love. And you share this deposit
together. She gravitated to the song because it was her. This was the Phyllis Hyman of that time.
I actually thought about Phyllis as the person telling the story when I wrote the lyrics. And it just came together like a perfect fit.
Yesterday I was somebody's baby. Now today I'm a woman. Oh, my
heart. I don't think people realize that that's her. Just uniquely talented and gifted singer.
Of a normal home life, I think she could have dealt with the pressures of the business a little better.
I was a little worried about Phyllis and these mood swings that she would go through. You know, one minute she would be very thin, you know, and 3-4 months later she started gaining weight again.
She used drugs and alcohol, and she specifically used cocaine. And she used them as a form of self-medication.
Gracia and others convinced Phyllis to enter therapy.
It appeared that she had periods of time where it was difficult for her to get out of bed, and then periods of time where she was very, very up, engaged, wanting to take on lots of projects. And watching the pattern over a period of time, my diagnosis was bipolar disorder.
Bipolar disorder can often be managed through a program of carefully prescribed medications. Untreated, it can worsen over time.
There's several family members who have mental illness in our family. A couple of them have bipolar. I was the first to get on medication, and I did very well for many, many, many years.
I convinced her to go into treatment. I knew that she was abusing alcohol and cocaine, and I wanted her to experience what it was like to be free of the substances.
Phyllis entered rehab in 1986 and emerged with a new sense of purpose.
I managed to produce and deliver, but personally I haven't dealt with it very well. I've had a lot of emotional ups and downs. As I said earlier, I have begun the process of recovery, so to speak, mm-hmm. You know, just trying to feel better about myself.
She was invigorated. She felt sort of like a new opportunity had been given to her with her sobriety.
Phyllis's career seemed reborn as well. The Living All Alone single rose to number 12 on the R&B charts, and the album sold nearly 500,000 copies. It was jubilated for us. She was happy. She felt like she was back in action again, and she was. With a hit album on her hands, Phyllis undertook an ambitious tour where her personality made every show and every stop an event.
There was a show she did at the Mann Music Center, and she's in the limo, and it was a guy selling counterfeit T-shirts, and Phyllis got out of the limo and chased the guy down.
Martha said you're acting silly.
We were in concert, and there was a young man in the front row, and he was on the phone. She stopped the song
and said, "Excuse me, do you see me singing?" So she said, "Give me the phone." And the guy's like, "Give me the phone." And so, you know, the guy gives her the phone. She said, "Sweetheart, I'm going to need for you not to be talking on this phone to your man during my concert. You should be here with him." And hung up the phone.
How many of you have seen me before? Good. I can take my shoes off now, can't I? Thanks. She would work, if there's 52 weekends in the year, for her to work 48 of them was like no big deal.
But while Phyllis was charming her public, she often alarmed her family and friends.
She took medication briefly, but she didn't like the way it made her feel. So I think she was afraid that she was going to lose her muse.
By this point, she was self-destructive. She was using food, she was using chemicals, she was using relationships as a way of buffering that pain.
In June 1990, Phyllis took an overdose of sleeping pills at her Philadelphia home.
She was in her bedroom, unconscious. And so we called the emergency, and they came and they got her. And that was very, very intense. When she finally came to, I was standing over her, and she was really happy that she wasn't dead.
She needed a long-term facility to go in and get stabilized, get off drugs, stay off drugs long enough to get on the right meds, to see which ones would work, trial and error, and then go back out into the world, supervised.
In January 1991, Phyllis agreed to go back to therapy. She checked herself into a rehab facility in Naples, Florida, to treat addictions for drugs, food, and alcohol.
When she came out of the hospital, I mean, it took her all of one day maybe to have her next drink.
Trying to revive her stage career in 1994, Phyllis broke her foot and was laid up for several weeks. Cavalier with her spending, Phyllis ran into recurring financial problems. All of this left Phyllis seeking solace in the familiar comforts of food, alcohol, and drugs.
The biggest shift for Phyllis started occurring in 1994 when she started gaining a lot of weight and was just desperately unhappy.
After a performance in Los Angeles that year, David Nathan interviewed Phyllis for Blues and Soul magazine.
She was reflective, and she did talk about some of the challenges she was dealing with personally. She talked about losing weight. She didn't reference exactly what, but she said, you know, she had been dealing with some substance abuse issues.
Regina Bell performed with Phyllis in April of 1995.
She was drinking. And it was just before we were going on stage, and it was a little scary because she was talking to me, and she had these two books sitting on the table, and they were books about death.
In early June, Phyllis returned to New York to prepare for her performance with the Whispers at the famed Apollo Theater. The concert was slated for June 30th, 1 week before her 46th birthday.
Phyllis's birthday could make her very depressed. And as she got older, it made her more depressed.
On June 30th, the day of the show, Phyllis instructed her assistants to wake her up in time for the afternoon sound check. When the assistants arrived, Phyllis's door was chain locked from the inside. She broke through it.
They found her in the bed. She was unconscious. It was critical, obviously, for them to get her to the hospital. But I had a sinking feeling that this was going to be her final attempt.
Phyllis was rushed to the hospital, but it was too late.
I had to make all those phone calls.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to bring this to a close. Mainly because, you know, I really don't really want to hear about the finalization of the levels of Phyllis Hyman. I had so much respect for her gifts. It just is too hard for me to take. I hated to hear that she had passed because I had so much respect for her ability. And the same thing with Roy Hargrove that happened last year, the year 2018, actually, 2 years ago now. I remember when he first busted in on the scene. Pure sound. Both of these two artists are going to be sorely missed, both of them with extreme talent. Phyllis Hyman with her drug abuse tell us exactly how musicians go through life and their conclusion because of them feeling alone. And as long as I can't help but feel alone is something that is what a lot of musicians and creative people experience. In any event, hopefully you've enjoyed the show as much as I've enjoyed bringing it to you. This has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean, and hopefully God will bless you and see you through this pandemic. Have a good evening.